Welcome to Radio Curious and part two of our series on funerals and burials in the United States. I'm Barry Vogel. Our guest in this program is Josh Slocum, the Executive Director of Consumers Alliance and co-author, along with Lisa Carlson, of Final Rights, Reclaiming the American Way of Death. Josh Slocum and I will discuss the cultural pathology about death that led to the loss of our rights to deal with our dead at death and to allow the state to regulate private family activities that we'd never tolerate in any other sphere. We visited by phone from his office near Burlington, Vermont, on August 30th, 2013, and began with his description of how we as a culture now deal with death.
Americans have a peculiar neurosis about how we deal with death, how we talk about it, what we think about it. That's not to say that there's any culture in the world where death is always a happy occasion, obviously not. But we here in North America, and I when I say that, I mean the U.S. and Canada, because for historical reasons, our culture and our funeral industries are really very much one and the same on this issue. We are so far removed from a frank encounter with death that I think we have made up all sorts of stories in our heads that are far more frightening than the reality.
What would some of those stories be?
Well, first of all, that death is optional, right? Now, I'm not saying that anyone literally believes that, but I am saying that many people subconsciously do believe it. There's a phenomenon I call death in the subjunctive. And it happens when people call the office here at Funeral Consumers Alliance and say, in a voice filled with trepidation, "Well, I don't need your services now, but if anything should ever happen to me," right? And of course, you immediately want to say, "You are going to die at some point," but you realize that it's such a frightening concept for people that they couch it in conditional terms and often apologize for asking questions, and they say things like, "God forbid anything should ever happen to my mother, but ... And I think that betrays a very, very deep anxiety and a feeling of utter lack of control about death and how to handle it.
Where do you feel this utter lack of control comes from, considering that death is a universal phenomenon? And it's probably not even a phenomenon.
Yeah, my guess is that it comes from a confluence of societal and historical factors. I know that you talked about this with my co-author, Lisa Carlson, but just to recap, the way we did death until the late 19th century was very much more a hands-on affair, and death occurred at home. The funeral was generally carried out at home by the family. The undertaker was a helpful presence, but not the funeral director that we know today. And of course, as we moved into cities and we began convalescing and then dying in hospitals rather than at home, the funeral home as a location for the deceased became universal. And so we have very, very little experience of death the way our great-great-grandparents would have. Anytime something seems mysterious, the human mind seems to have a propensity to find it frightening. We're afraid of the unknown. And I think that's what it is, because I think that we're so separated from the ordinary reality of death. The only way we experience it is in movies and television or in war reporting in ways that are, either tragic by their nature or highly dramatized. And to the extent that we end up arranging a funeral, most people will arrange one funeral for another family member in a lifetime, sometimes two, but usually just one. It's really a sleepwalking kind of affair, right? Instead of approaching it the way we approach other really important or potentially expensive purchases, we tend to be walking blank checks, and we don't think about it beforehand. We don't shop around. We don't talk to our family about how to do it. So we're sort of numb through the funeral buying process.
That brings us to the question of who's in charge from one perspective, and from another, why this abandonment of handling a necessary life activity?
Well, I think the abandonment is for practical and cultural reasons. I discussed some of them. You know, we don't live on the farm, most of us, anymore. And it certainly is convenient to be able to call on a funeral home, whether you want burial or cremation, simple or elaborate. Not everybody is emotionally or physically equipped to actually handle the death. But we've gone farther than simply seeing funeral homes as a convenience. We've gotten to the point where we think of them as a necessity. Not only a necessity in terms of, oh my goodness, I could never handle this myself, thank God for the funeral home, but many people, in fact, I'd say more than half of people that you'd ask on the street would think that you're legally required to use a funeral home. And this is extraordinary when you step back and think about it. You know, for all of our talk as Americans about self-sufficiency and independence and privacy and autonomy of choice for our families and our lives, we become curiously passive in front of the idea that, you know, the funeral industry and all of the mechanisms that make it up somehow have almost an ethical claim to our business and to our dead. Let me give a concrete example. The Funeral Consumers Alliance advocates across the spectrum for all types of families. If you want to do a home do-it-yourself funeral, we will help you. If you need to find out how to shop for a cremation, we will help you do that. If you want a full-service funeral with all the trimmings but you don't want to overpay, we'll advise you on that. So we don't take a prescriptive attitude toward death. But we end up having to spend much more time, as you can imagine, fighting for the rights of people to do things that are unusual, right? Because things that are in the minority are always sort of teetering on the precipice of being run over by majority preferences. So we have to expend disproportionate amount of time pushing for the right of families in several states to continue to care for their dead without the state compelling them to hire a funeral home. Why do we have to do this? Well, because we have this curious passivity in the face of death that we don't have in anything else. So imagine, for example, it would be inconceivable for a hospital to say to us, little Johnny's been in here for 5 days, he's cured of pneumonia, you can take him home, but I'm sorry, Mr. Smith, you may not take physical custody of little Johnny. You must hire a state-licensed and inspected medical transport facility to bring him to your home. We'd find that just Twilight Zone bizarre. But that's what happens often with death. Right now in Minnesota, I'm working with some home funeral advocates there who are having to fight with hospitals who are claiming a legal right that they don't have and saying that they can restrict parents from bringing their deceased children home, that they can require them to hire a funeral director. And they claim that these are liability issues, which of course is perverse when you look at it, because by denying the parents the undisputed legal and common law custody they have in their deceased children, when in fact hospitals are creating liability for themselves by denying parents the custody of their deceased children and requiring them to hire an unwanted and unnecessary third-party business. Now, again, people would say, but no one would ever do that. And no one should do that with a dead person either. There is no law in the state of Vermont that says you may change your own oil and service your own transmission without hiring a car dealer. But that doesn't mean that it's illegal for Josh Slocum to change his oil, right? We don't need a state statute to give us permission to do ordinary things that don't affect other people. But this attitude that we do and that is reasonable and everyone agrees it's reasonable is very common when it comes to dead people. And that is something I really work hard to try to change.
I want to stay back for a minute with the Funeral Consumers Alliance, of which you are the executive director. the Funeral Consumers Alliance does not charge for their services. They operate as a nonprofit corporation by donation and membership. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, good. I wanted to make that clear for our listeners.
You know, in IRS jargon, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, the kind of organization where you can take a tax deduction if you choose to give us a gift. So we're all familiar with that if we donated to public radio or the Red Cross.
And what I'd also like to do is say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we are visiting with Josh Slocum, the executive director of the Funeral Consumers Alliance based in Vermont. He's also the co-author of Final Rites, Reclaiming the American Way of Death. His co-author is Lisa Carlson. She has been on Radio Curious previously, and you can hear our interview with her on our website, radiocurious.org. You are listening to Radio Curious. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Josh, the control that the states have in the regulatory system, would it be fair to say that this control, which is does not exist in the home preparation of food or the home car repair circumstances that you mentioned, is taken over how we control our dead and how we regulate our dead?
This is an out of the ordinary and noteworthy way in which the state exerts control that we would never tolerate if it were anything but the topic of dead people. I mean, it just no state would even try it, right? Here are the states where there is some legal impediment to full control over your funeral that in some way you need to hire a funeral director. Connecticut, Illinois, Indiana, Nebraska, New York, New Jersey, Michigan, and Louisiana. Now, they're all different. None of those states have an explicit plain English sentence that says, you must hire a funeral home when your loved one dies. The law doesn't work that way. Let me take New York as an example. The statutes are in flagrant contradiction in New York State. I mean, portions of the statutes very clearly give citizens the right to determine the manner in which their death is handled. Other statutes conflict with that by, for example, requiring that every single burial or cremation or funeral-related ceremony be supervised by a state-licensed funeral director. Think about that for a second. You have to hire a babysitter, basically, to stand there and make sure that, what? You say the correct prayers over the coffin? It's offensive, and it's ridiculous. And in New York State still, the law actually makes it very clear that you do not have to be a licensed funeral director if all you're doing is transporting the dead from the place of death to the cemetery. It's very clear that this is a job that can be farmed out to non-funeral directors. So if that is the case, you know, we certainly have funeral homes in New York who are hiring, you know, probably 21-year-old college kids who are willing to do body removals for a small fee. That's fine. That's completely and totally fine, but you, the New York citizen, cannot be trusted to stand next to the casket at the graveside for your wife without an undertaker supervising you. It's like through the looking glass.
It sounds like that if there were a home ceremony, a home funeral, do you have to have a funeral director there? I mean, that's a bit of a stretch.
Reading the law plainly, it would say yes. Now, do I think that... If mom dies at home and you decide to have a day and a half of visitation with family over before you call the funeral director, do I think that any state agency would come in and try to bring you up on charges for not having immediately hired a funeral director? No, I don't think that. But it's not that far outside the realm of possibility. In Pennsylvania a few years ago, a member of our organization, Phyllis Ingold, had a home funeral for her mother, along with her sister, Lucy. Phyllis and Lucy had done this before in the family and decided to do so again. Now, in Pennsylvania, it is uncontroversially legal. You do not have to hire a funeral director. This is not a gray area. And somebody in the neighborhood, I believe it was a funeral director, was so upset at the idea that there was a dead body in the house that they called the police department. And the police showed up knocking on Phyllis's door during the funeral and saying, I'm very sorry, ma'am, but someone says you have a dead body here. I mean, and I've broken what law? The law against people dying at home? I mean, it's when you step back and you look at it in context, I hope that people can begin to see how invasive and absurd this is. And it speaks to that neurosis that I was telling you about, the utter terror. And it's an existential terror of dealing with death. And it causes people who are ordinarily rational, self-determined, competent, confident people to completely lose their marbles and acquiesce to all sorts of nonsense that that they shouldn't have to acquiesce to.
Let's move on after the funeral to the topic of home burials on rural property or large acreage property. That's certainly been an issue in California, but tell us about it on a national basis from your observation.
With the exception of a handful of states like Washington and California to some degree, but with those exceptions, most state laws are silent on the issue, preferring to leave it to the local county or township or municipality. The general rule is home burial is usually permissible, and let me take a second to distinguish because people often confuse these. When I say home burial, all I mean is the physical burial of that body on the land. I do not mean family-directed funeral. That may go with it, but it doesn't necessarily. So I'm talking about the location of the casket on your own land. With the exception of those, for the most part, if you live outside city limits, outside suburban limits, and you've got some rural acreage, home burial is usually permissible, but it's a decision that is left to the municipal authority.
And to the landowner, obviously.
Oh, well, sure, of course. I don't believe that anybody is going around out there trying to bury their dead on other people's property unless we have an organized crime ring going.
Which, at times, in the work that we've done here in California on a successful case recently in Mendocino County, one of the concerns was, what if somebody kills a person and buries them? And we're talking about a known death with a death certificate, with a burial permit, with certain standards of depth and distance from boundary lines and water courses being met.
There's a common misconception that burial at home will somehow allow people to get away with murder. You will hear this frequently. They'll say, but what if you just want to kill Granny to get the estate money and just bury her on your property? Well, that doesn't make sense, right? Because as you mentioned, we're not talking about suspicious or uninvestigated deaths. We're talking about deaths where there is a death certificate. And that which makes the death certificate legal is the physician's signature or the medical examiner's signature that says, I, Dr. So-and-so, say this death is known, the cause is known, there is no foul play. Once that is filed, the state's interest in the body is completely satisfied, that the death is now legal. This is what we're talking about. So we're talking about having all the proper permits, everything above board. And when you think about it, you know, if you wanted to murder Granny to get the estate money, how likely is it that you are going to walk down to the registrar's office at the county clerk and ask for a death certificate? Really? That's not how murderers work. So that's a red herring.
Josh Slocum, author of Final Rights, Reclaiming the American Way of Death. In your work, what kinds of abuses, if any, have you encountered within the funeral industry?
Oh, all of them. most commonly are complaints of funeral directors refusing to disclose prices the way the law requires them to do, making misleading statements to people, like claiming that embalming is required by law when that's usually not the case. We get a lot of complaints about prepaid funerals and the problems that go wrong with them. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is really, it's kind of enabled and exacerbated by the very poor state of the regulatory system. You know, we have the funeral rule from the Federal Trade Commission, which is a standard basic consumer rights type of reg that says to funeral directors, you have to be honest, you have to disclose prices, you have to allow freedom of choice in purchase. But at the state level, we've got 50 states and the District of Columbia, all with their own regulatory apparatus to oversee their state's funeral homes. And with the exception of maybe two or three states, the entire system is completely dominated numerically and in voting numbers by funeral directors. It is the classic fox guarding the hen house. And the first chapter of my book is called Circling the Hearses, and it is an overview of the absolutely scandalous way that the state regulatory system functions to protect the funeral industry from the consuming public. And if folks are interested in that, that chapter is available free as a sort of an appetizer for the book. You can check it out at the book's website, which is finalrights.org, and rights is spelled R-I-G-H-T-S. And our website, of course, for Funeral Consumers Alliance is funerals.org. Make sure you have the S on funerals. So, you know, we've heard everything, and we've testified to various state legislatures. I've testified to congressional committees, and we've worked with the FTC for a very long time on these issues.
Well, one of the things that I do in my professional life as an attorney is create estate plans for people, wills and trusts. And many people will come and with a smile tell me they have made prepaid funeral arrangements. You mentioned there's problems with that. Can you share those problems with us?
Sure. It can be a complicated topic, and folks can find lots of good general information on our site. So I'll just as a quick summary, all prepaid contracts are regulated differently depending on the state they're in. So in some states like New York, you've got pretty good protections. All of your money has to go into trust. You can get a refund if you change your mind before death. Then you go all the way to the other end of the spectrum in Florida, and you can lose between 30 and 60% of your prepayment if you change your mind and move out of state. And you've got everything in between. And aside from the fact that at least $1 billion has been misappropriated or stolen over the past 10 years from prepaid accounts, the idea of doing that and the idea of it's all taken care of is a very dangerous delusion that we tell ourselves. Don't ever believe that you can, quote, take care of everything. You can't predict everything that will happen. You can't sort of pre-do your funeral ahead of time such that your survivors make no decisions. That's not realistic. Planning is wonderful, but paying for it ahead of time is not a magic fix on future activities. We really, really urge people not to do it unless they have to spend down their assets for Medicaid.
Some of the areas that cannot be predicted that you mentioned, what are they?
Death might occur several states away from home where dad prepaid for his funeral. What will you do then? How much money will you get back to pay the funeral home in the new state? How long will it take? What if cremation is the only practical option and you've prepaid for a casket and a burial plot and all these things? You're not going to get all of your money back, even in the best states. And really, at bottom, what I find is people who have prepaid for their funerals, their children are, generally speaking, the worst prepared to deal with the funeral. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but think of it this way. People who prepay tend to want to control the future, and they tend to want to take it out of their children's hands, usually for good reasons. But in so doing, they neglect to educate their kids about how to make funeral decisions, what to do if plans change, what to do if there isn't enough money. And when you set up the expectation with your kids that mommy and daddy took care of it all with that nice man at the mortuary, if anything goes awry, those kids are in hysterics on the phone with me. So, you know, just like you don't send your kids out into the world at 18 saying, you know, dad made sure your car was all prepaid for when you need a new one at 35. You teach them how to shop for a car. Do the same for funerals.
Well, Josh Slocum, co-author of Final Rights, Reclaiming the American Way of Death, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask some questions about you.
Sure.
And the first one is, Can you tell us about an aha or eureka moment that changed your life or your way of thinking?
Yeah, I think the one that stands out the most to me happened when I was seven. And that day, my awareness of class issues and economic issues was cemented and clarified. I grew up in a poor family in Southern California for 5 years, and single-parent family. It was my mom and us three kids, living on a combination of my mom's part-time cashier's salary at a 7-Eleven, food stamps, and welfare. So we were always dressed in hand-me-down clothes and Salvation Army cast-offs. And one day we were walking to the grocery store, because we didn't have a car, and my mom had us kids by the hands, and we walked up to the front of the supermarket, and this was, 1981 or 82, fresh-faced college kid with a 1970s fro and mustache came up to my mom with a clipboard, all earnest, and said, "Ma'am, would you like to sign a petition against welfare fraud?" And my mother, I remember this so vividly, she stopped there and got a livid look on her face, and she pointed to us, and she said, "Do you see any welfare fraud here?" And it was at that moment that a light bulb came on, and I understood that the reality of what is derided and mocked by our politicians as class warfare is actually real. So it's foundational to the way I think about the world.
That's a compelling story.
I thought so. My mom's a compelling woman.
That being said, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I don't try to predict the future. I'm very happy with my work. I feel really, really lucky that I get to make a living not selling people widgets they don't need, but you know, at least trying to help them get something that they do need. This job is, I think the work is important no matter who does it, but I feel very lucky to have it, and I hope that I'm able to spend the rest of my working life doing good in human services or in the nonprofit sector in some fashion.
And finally, Josh Slocum, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene. Not only did The Selfish Gene explain the beauty and really the simplicity of the idea of natural selection, evolution by natural selection, but it prompted me to read more widely. So it started me off on a science education that I didn't get in grammar school or high school or in college, and that I didn't know I needed, and that I didn't know was so fantastic and wonderful. So I highly recommend the book.
Well, Josh Slocum, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Josh Slocum is the executive director of the Funeral Consumers Alliance and co-author of Final Rites, Reclaiming the American Way of Death. His website is funerals.org. The book he recommends is The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins. The Radio Curious interview with Lisa Carlson, the other co-author of Final Rites, is found on the Radio Curious website, radiocurious.org. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. The phone is 707-462-6541. And email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.